immense, and very little of the pale gold August sun gets through. Within a few feet, she feels the temperature begin to drop. She holds her compass in her right hand and follows the path alongside the arrow telling her where to go. After 20 minutes, the denseness of the middle of the woods starts to thin out again, and there are established footpaths meandering through the trees, signs of humanity, pieces of litter, a dog poo in a green plastic bag hanging from a branch. She checks her map again now that she has briefly regained her phone signal and finds that she is about to emerge onto a bridle way. She moves the map across her screen with her fingers and sees the linear representation of a large building to her right. After a moment, she sees a turret and a weather vane. Then she sees the curve of an ancient brick wall and a curtain of bright red Virginia creeper. She squeezes through a parade of trees that abuts the wall and finds herself in front of a rusty metal gate, a broken padlock hanging from its bars. And then she is through the gate and into a clump of woodland. The shimmer of blue sky is visible ahead of her, and then she is on a ragged, sun-bleached lawn that rolls downwards via wide stone steps, overgrown with thistles, towards a house that looks like something from a Tim Burton movie. Sophie catches her breath and puts a hand to her throat. As she runs down the tiered lawns towards the house, she sees the pool appear. It's dark green, a ripped cover half pulled across it, mulchy dead leaves from the previous winter stacked around it. A pagoda at one end of the pool has been covered in boldly coloured graffiti. The terrace between the pool and the house is littered with empty beer cans and cigarette ends, drug paraphernalia, and discarded crisp packets and takeaway containers. How, Sophie wonders, could a house of this magnificence, not to mention market value, have been left like this? Why is it not being cared for, even while it is uninhabited? She picks her way around the house, trying to peer into windows through gaps in the shutters. At the front of the house is an ornate courtyard, and beyond that, a long cypress-lined driveway that appears to go on for a mile or more. She turns to look at the front door. Above the fanlight, carved into the dark brickwork, is the date, AD 1721. The air is thick and silent here, and nothing else in sight. This house exists almost on an island. Sophie wonders about the family who lived here, the hedge fund manager and his glamorous wife and their talented teenage daughter. Where are they now? And what on earth possessed them to leave a place like this to go to seed? She checks the time on her phone. It's nearly midday. She stands at the top end of the garden to survey the grandeur of the house one more time. She takes a photograph, then tucks her phone into her rucksack and heads back down the bridle way and into the woods. Chapter 8, October 2016. Zach called again. Tallulah glances at her mum. About an hour ago, wondered if I knew where you were because you weren't answering your phone. She shrugs and heads to the baby monitor on the kitchen counter and puts her ear to it, listening for the sound of her son's sleeping breath. How long has he been down? About 35 minutes. She glances at the time. It's 4:30. He'll be hungry any minute. She has a small window of time to get changed, to have a cup of tea, to sort out her college work. She's been at college for 4 weeks now and has got into a really solid routine. Are you going to call him?
Who?
Zach, her mum replies impatiently. Are you going to call him? You can't ignore him forever. Tallulah nods.
I know, she says. I know.
She unknots the laces on her trainers and pulls them off. Then she sighs. Zach asked if they could get back together when he came to visit Noah on Saturday. It was weird because when she was pregnant, all she wanted in the whole world was to be back together with Zach. But now she's a mum. Now she's at college. It's like she's not that same person anymore. And the person she is now doesn't want to be with anyone. She just wants to share her bed, her body, with Noah. She and Zach had been together for nearly 3 years when she got pregnant. She hadn't told him she was pregnant until she was 4 months gone,
and then he'd freaked out and said he needed time to decide how he felt about it. And now he knows how he feels about it, but Tallulah's no longer sure that she does. "He's a good boy, you know," her mum continues.
"Yes, I know."
She tries to hide her exasperation. She owes her mum everything right now and doesn't want to sound ungrateful.
"I just don't know what to say to him."
"You could just say that," her mum suggests.
"Yes, but then he might try to talk me round and I haven't got the energy for it."
Tallulah's so tired all the time. During the summer, it had been fine. Noah slept most of the day when he was a newborn, so she had plenty of time to catch up on her sleep. But now he's older and more wakeful. She's at college 3 mornings a week and has study to do on her days at home, and daytime sleeps are a thing of the past.
"If Zach starts crying or something, I'll cave. I know I will."
Her mum passes her a mug of tea, pulls out the chair opposite her and sits down.
"But what is it," she begins, "that you're not sure about?"
I don't... But she's saved from having to find the words to explain something she cannot explain by the sound of Noah on the baby monitor, rousing from his afternoon sleep. Her mum goes to stand up, but Tallulah wants the bliss and the distraction of scooping her boy from his warm bedsheets and rolling him into her arms, against her chest, the sweet heat of his breath against her collarbone.
"I'll go,"
she says.
"I'll go."
The following day, Tallulah has college in the morning. She leaves the house with a vignette imprinted on her mind of Noah in her mother's arms, Ryan in his school uniform microwaving Noah's milk for her because she's late and doesn't have time to do it herself, and stands at the bus stop opposite their cul-de-sac. The bus is late. After all her rushing about and not saying goodbye properly to her baby son, she sighs impatiently. She's aware then of a presence beside her and turns to see Scarlett Jax sliding along the plastic bench.
"Haven't missed it then,"
she says breathlessly. Tallulah doesn't realise for a split second that Scarlett is talking to her and fails to respond.
"I'll take that as a no," says Scarlett.
"Sorry," says Tallulah.
"Yeah, I mean, no, you haven't missed it. It's late."
"Phew,"
says Scarlett, pulling earbuds from the pocket of her oversized raincoat and starting to put them in her ears. Then she stops and says,
"I know you, don't I? You're at Manton College, yes?"
Tallulah nods. Scarlett nods too and says,
"I've seen you around. What course are you on?"
"Social care, first year."
"Ah, so you're new too."
"Yeah, a few weeks in. How about you?"
asks Tallulah, although she knows exactly which course Scarlett's on.
"Fine art, first year?"
"That's cool,"
says Tallulah, and then wishes she hadn't said cool.
"Well, yeah, it's shit, really. I mean, I wanted to go to art school in London, but my parents wouldn't let me because of all the travelling. And I said, well, then rent me a little flat. And they said, no way. And then I didn't get a good enough grade in my art A-level to get into any of the good colleges anyway. Not because I'm not good at art, but just because I didn't do the work I needed to do. Story of my life. And yeah, here I am."
They both turn at the distinctive rumble of the old-fashioned green bus that services the area as it appears on the far side of the common.
"Do you live round here, then?" asks Tallulah.
"No. Well, kind of. About 2 miles away. But I spent the night with my boyfriend. He's at Maypole."
She shrugs in the direction of the imposing old manor house across the common.
"Are you allowed to sleep over there?"
"Nope. Most definitely not. But I have a special relationship with the matron there. She loves me. And I'm kind of friends with her daughter too, so she turns a blind eye."
The bus approaches and they get to their feet. Tallulah doesn't know what happens now. Will they sit together? Will they continue to talk? But the decision is taken from her. Scarlett sees a friend at the back of the bus and strides away from Tallulah, throwing her school bag down on the seat and then herself, her voice travelling loudly, almost gratingly down the aisle to the front of the bus where Tallulah sits alone. But when Tallulah turns, just once, to look at Scarlett, she finds Scarlett looking straight back at her. Chapter 9, June 2017.
Kim strips off her clothes and gets into the shower quickly, before the water has run warm. The whole episode at Scarlett's house has left her feeling filthy and exhausted. She pictures Scarlett's mother standing at her front door with her big panting dog, watching them pushing Noah's buggy awkwardly down the gravel pathway and onto the drive.
"I'd offer you a lift," she'd called out. "But I've had a few drinks, sorry."
Kim's car was like an oven by the time they'd returned to it, and Noah was now tired and hungry and screamed all the way from the bottom of the driveway to the parking space outside Kim's house, whereupon he immediately fell asleep. Ryan is sitting out in the car with him now. In the shower, she can taste the salt of her own sweat as water passes down her face. Every few seconds, she peers through the gap in the shower curtain at her phone, which she's left perched on the sink, balanced against the toothbrush mug, looking to see if she's missed a call or a message. After showering, she gets into clean shorts and a fresh bra and top. Everything she was wearing earlier is damp and dank and heading for the laundry basket. She glances at her phone again. Still, nothing. Fear grips her gut again. It comes and goes in waves. She sits on the edge of her bed and thinks about the woods behind Scarlett's house. She tries to imagine Zack and Tallulah waiting in the dark for a taxi that didn't come, giving up after a while, and one of them saying, "Those woods take us back to Upfield. We could try cutting through there." It had been a warm night. It might even have sounded appealing, and maybe they thought the fresh air would help clear Tallulah's head. Kim calls Megs.
"Would you mind," she says, "if I dropped Noah with you for a while? I think I know where Zack and Tallulah might be, and I'd like to go and have a look."
There's a pause. Then Meg says,
"So they're not back yet?"
Kim closes her eyes. It's different with sons, she knows that. But still, she's frustrated by Meg's lack of concern. She pictures her just as she'd left her this morning, stretched out in her back garden with her edgy husband, enjoying not having any responsibilities, any agenda. "No," she says, "they're not. And none of the local taxi firms has a record of picking them up from their friend's house last night. So I have a theory that they might be lost in the woods, behind the college. I want to go and have a look."
"Oh," says Megs. "Right."
Then, "Seems unlikely. I mean, it's almost 5 o'clock. That would mean they've been in those woods since last night. Surely no one could get lost in there for that long."
"Well, maybe. They had an accident. Fell down at, I don't know, an old well or something. Anyway, I'll be over with Noah in a bit. See you soon."
She ends the call without waiting to hear what else Megs might have to say. Kim and Ryan spend 2 hours scouring the woods, but there is no sign of them. No wells, no holes, no traps, no dropped clues, nothing. As they pass the accommodation block in the grounds of Maypole House afterwards, Kim glances up at the windows. She remembers Scarlett telling them that Kerri-Ann Mulligan's daughter had been with them the night before. Lexi, she said her name was. She and Ryan head for the security gate and ring on a buzzer that says, "Residence Manager." A woman replies.
"Oh, hi, is that Kerri-Ann?"
"Yes, speaking."
"Hi, this is Kim Knox. I live across the common. I think my mum used to look after your mum when she was at Springdale."
"Yes, yes, I know you. And I remember your mum. She used to bring Jamaican ginger loaf to my mum's room when I came to visit her for tea. Paula, wasn't it?"
Kim smiles at the sound of her mother's name.
"Yes, that's right. And your mum was called Vanda."
"Yes, that's right. Well remembered. How are you? Do you want to come in?"
Yes, thank you. I've got my son with me."
"Lovely," says Kerri-Ann. "Second floor, room 205.
There's the smell of cooking in Kerri-Ann's flat, something steaming on a hob. A younger woman sits on the L-shaped sofa facing a terrace that overlooks the woods that Kim has just been trawling for her daughter and her boyfriend.
"Come in," says Kerri-Ann. Come in. This is my daughter, Lexi. She's staying with me for a few days. Lexi, this is Kim. She's the daughter of one of Nana's carers from Springdale. And your mum, is she?
Kim shakes her head.
No, she died 2 years ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. She must have been very young.
62, she says.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. Not that much older than me. I'm so sorry.
Yes, well, and your mother, is she?
4 years ago. But she was 88, so, you know, I can't complain. But she loved your mum. She really did.
They smile sadly at each other for a minute, thinking of their poor dead mothers. Then Kerri-Anne rallies and says,
Anyway, what can I do for you?
Well, says Kim. Actually, it was Lexi I wanted to talk to.
Lexi turns at the sound of her name and says,
Oh.
Lexi is a pretty young woman, with mahogany hair cut into a bob, with a blunt fringe, large black-framed reading glasses, skinny jeans and an artfully scruffy T-shirt.
You were at Scarlett's house last night.
Yes, she answers brightly. How did you know?
Well, because my daughter was there too, Tallulah, and her boyfriend Zach, and the thing is that Tallulah and Zach haven't come home, and apparently they left there at 3 a.m. We've just been in the woods at the back.
Kim gestures through the glass sliding door.
I thought maybe they'd got lost coming back, but no sign of them. And I know you left early, but I just wondered if you noticed anything, knew anything, saw anything, because I'm running out of ideas here.
She's been trying to keep her voice on an even keel, keep her tone normal, but her words begin to crack apart as she reaches her conclusion, and then she finds that she is crying. Kerri-Anne rushes to the kitchen to find her a tissue, and Lexi looks at her with genuine concern.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry. How horrible. You must be so worried.
Kim nods and takes the tissue from Kerri-Anne, holds it to her cheeks.
I mean, she says, I'm sure it's nothing. I'm sure they just, you know, kids, they just...
But she peters off, because she's not sure of any such thing. The only thing she's sure of is that Tallulah would never leave Noah deliberately, and that something terrible must have happened to her. Kerri-Anne leads Kim and Ryan to the large sofa and invites them to sit down.
Honestly, Lexi begins, I wish there was something I could tell you, but there really isn't. I was at the pub, the Swan and Ducks, with an old school friend. Then there was this group in there, a young group, late teens, early 20s, and they were being quite rowdy. I recognised one of them, Scarlett. She used to be a student here. We've always been quite friendly, so I went to say hello, and before I knew it, I was being dragged into their little group, and it felt a bit weird because obviously I'm quite a bit older than them. Plus, I was sober, and they were not.
And was Tallulah there then?
Yes, she was there. She was sitting with a boy, her boyfriend, I think.
Kim nods.
They seemed a bit quiet at first, I noticed that, and then Scarlett got a load of shots for the table and then another, and everyone got even noisier and noisier, and then it was closing time and they were all talking about walking back to Scarlett's house through the woods, and I thought that was just an accident waiting to happen, so I offered to drive them there.
All of them?
No, not all of them, just five of them. It was a bit of a squeeze and not entirely legal, but I still thought it was safer than them all walking through the woods off their heads.
And what happened when you got back there?
Well, it was so warm last night, as you know, and the lights were all on in their pool and they all just stripped off and jumped in.
Including Tallulah?
Yeah, she jumped in her top and pants. She looked kind of self-conscious.
Well, yes, she's carrying a little baby weight still.
She has a baby.
Lexi looks surprised.
Yes, Noah. He's one.
Gosh, she looks so young.
She is.
Kim holds down another burst of tears and forces a smile.
So, they all jumped in the pool, and then what? Well, I kind of... At this point, I felt like I needed to supervise. I mean, Scarlett's mum was somewhere indoors, sleeping, I think. And I realised I was the only sober person at the party, so I needed to keep an eye on everyone. I ended up staying until about one. By that time, everyone was out of the pool and there was a bit of... She looks at Kim quickly from the corner of her eye. Weed, a bit of vodka, music, but it had calmed down a bit. Tallulah and her boyfriend went indoors. Then Mimi went indoors, so I decided to head back. This guy Liam catched a lift back with me because he works here at the school, and that was that.
Liam? Kim asks cagily.
Who is Liam?
He's a teaching assistant here. He lives in the apartment above us. He used to go out with Scarlett, but they're still friends.
Is he... I mean, is he...
Kim can't find the words. Lexi shakes her head.
Oh, she says. No. God, no, you don't need to worry about Liam. He's the nicest guy in the world, honestly.
Kim nods circumspectly. Then she says,
And was there anything last night beneath the surface? Did you get the feeling that there was anything untoward going on?
Lexi turns out her bottom lip and shakes her head slowly.
No.
And when you left, who was still there?
Tallulah, her boyfriend, Scarlett and Mimi.
Well, says Kim, already starting to get to her feet.
Thank you so much, Lexi. I really appreciate your time. And thank you so much for going back with them all last night, for keeping them safe. Drunk kids in swimming pools. Doesn't bear thinking about.
No, says Lexi. That's what I thought.
Well, thank you. And this Liam, do you think it would be worth talking to him? Might he have any idea?
I doubt it, Lexi replies apologetically. He wouldn't have seen much more than I did. Kim looks at the time on her phone. It's nearly 6 o'clock. She turns to Carrie Anne.
Do you think I should call the police?
She asks softly.
It's been 15 hours. What would you do?
Carrie Anne sighs.
Well, it's different for me in loco parentis and all that. I'd move quite quickly if someone went missing from school. And in fact, they have, and I called out search and rescue within a few hours. But as a mother,
she pauses, I don't know. I mean, Tallulah and Zach are technically adults. They'd been drinking, taking drugs, sounds like they've got responsibilities beyond those of normal teenagers. I'd be tempted to look at the bigger picture. I mean, is it possible they've just run away? In a mad moment of spontaneity?
Kim closes her eyes and measures her response.
No, she says. No, definitely not.
And between them, as a couple, I mean, was there anything afoot? Maybe they'd had a row. Maybe something happened.
And there it is. The thing that's been gnawing away inside Kim's head all day long. The little box she found in Zach's jacket pocket the day before when she was looking for the spare door keys she'd lent him. The box with the ring in it, with the small but very clear diamond set on a golden band. She'd been expecting them to come back from the pub last night engaged. She wasn't sure how she felt about it. They were so young and she wasn't convinced that Tallulah was entirely committed to Zach. But she'd been ready for it. Ready to look amazed and delighted and to hug them both to her and tell them she was thrilled and to take a photo and text it to Tallulah's dad and put it on Facebook and all of that. She'd been ready for it. Even if she thought it was wrong. Because that's what you did, wasn't it? When you had a baby. When you had a man who loved you. You got married. But then Kim thinks of how long it had taken Tallulah to agree to get back together with Zach after Noah was born. She thinks of how Tallulah shrugs Zach's touch from her shoulder, from her arm, the roll of her eyes behind his back sometimes. She's been meaning to start a conversation with Tallulah for a few weeks, just to check in, to make sure she's still happy that she took Zach back. But she hasn't. And then they'd planned this night out together and Kim saw it as a sign that things were getting better between them. And then she'd found the ring. So what, she wonders,
if Zack had asked Tallulah to marry him, and Tallulah had said no. Because Zack is a good boy, but he has a temper. She's seen it flare from time to time when he's watching sport on the TV, or when he drops something and hurts himself, or someone cuts him up when he's driving. How might a rejection of his marriage proposal have triggered that temper? How might he have responded? Chapter 10, August 2018. Sophie and Sean arrive at Kerry Ann's apartment at 8 o'clock that evening, clutching a cold bottle of wine. The apartment has glass sliding doors, almost the full width of her living room, facing directly towards the setting sun. It's hot and stuffy. A large chrome fan plugged into the wall provides a little relief.
Sorry, she says to Sophie and Sean. It gets so hot in here on a sunny day. The heat gets trapped. Come, she says. We can sit on the terrace.
There's a wickerwork sofa on her terrace and a table set with crisps in bowls and wine glasses and a candle in a jar. Sophie sits down first, followed by Sean. The view across the woods is beautiful. The sky is turquoise, streaked with coral. A half moon is just emerging from the shadows.
This is lovely, says Sophie. What a different world to the cottage. Yes, the cottage is lovely, but you don't get the views, but then again, you don't get the heat either.
She pours wine into three glasses and raises hers to Sean.
Cheers, she says, to my fifth head teacher, and to you too, Sophie, my first head teacher's significant other.
Are we the first unmarried couple? Sophie asks.
You are, yes.
Is it a terrible scandal? Asks Sophie.
Oh, God, no. Maybe 20 years ago, eyebrows would have been raised, but not now. I don't think anyone cares about these things anymore, do they? And actually, Jacinta Croft, your predecessor, Sean, she arrived married but left single. Her husband did a runner. One of those popping out for a pint of milk scenarios. No one ever found out why. It's pretty much why she left, because of the scandal of it. So no, you two will not cause any wagging tongues, I could promise you that.
They chat for a while about Sean's first day at work, about the school he used to teach at in Lewisham, about the differences between the two areas, the two schools. Then Kerry Ann turns to Sophie and says,
Peter Doody tells me you're a writer, Sophie. Detective novels, he said.
Yes. Sophie smiles. Though I doubt you'd have read them. They're quite niche. I'm big in Scandinavia. She laughs the laugh she always laughs when she has to explain to people why they've probably never heard of her.
I told my daughter about you, Kerry Ann says. She's the reader in the family, not me. I think she might even have ordered one of your books. What are they called again?
The series is called The Little Hither Green Detective Agency. I write under the name PJ Fox.
I tell you what, she says, if you want any inspiration for your books, I could tell you some stories about this place. I mean, I could tell you some really, really hair-raising stuff. We had the police here twice last year alone, trawling those woods for missing people.
Sophie thinks of the abandoned mansion beyond the woods.
Wow.
She says. What happened? Kerry Ann glances across at Sean and says,
Probably a bit indiscreet. Maybe not.
But she throws Sophie a sideways glance that tells her there'll be another time. The following day, Sophie gets up with Sean at 6 a.m. and they breakfast outdoors together, the golden rays of another beautiful late August day strobing through the trees and across the tablecloth.
What will you do today?
Asks Sean, collecting the plates and cutlery and piling them together.
Will you go for another epic walk?
No, she says. Not today. I thought I might explore the village today. Maybe get some lunch at the infamous Swan and Ducks.
I'll try and join you, says Sean.
That would be very nice indeed. After Sean leaves, Sophie spends some time unpacking boxes in the cottage.
Then she makes herself another cup of coffee and takes her laptop to the kitchen table and replies to some emails. She is flying to Denmark in just over a week's time to attend a crime festival as PJ Fox, and there are some last-minute additions to her itinerary, including an interview with a TV station, which means she'll want to do something about her hair before she goes. She thinks maybe she'll take a day trip into London, visit her stylist there, maybe have lunch with someone, see if her publishers would like her to visit. She feels herself get quite excited at the prospect. After a while, she switches screens to her latest manuscript. She hasn't looked at it for days. Life has been nothing but packing and unpacking, and saying goodbye and saying hello. She hasn't been in the right headspace to get any work done. But now she has no excuse. The tail end of her last paragraph stares at her blankly, something she wrote in another world when she was a Londoner, when she had a boyfriend who taught at a sprawling Lewisham secondary school, when moving to Surrey was a date in her diary rather than her reality. She stares back at it for a moment, then scrolls upwards through the rest of the chapter, trying to slot herself back into London Sophie, but just can't do it. Instead, she flicks screens to her browser and types in Maypole House and missing person. She sets the filter to news and clicks on the first link in the results. Local teen parents remain missing after night out. Upfield Common resident Kim Knox, 39, has reported the disappearance of her daughter, 19-year-old Tallulah Murray, and her boyfriend Zach Alistair, also 19, who have not been seen since the early hours of Saturday morning. Murray and Alistair, who have a one-year-old son together, spent the previous evening at the Swan and Ducks pub before taking a lift with a local friend to a private home near Upley Fold, where they partied with friends, former students at Maypole House, until 3 o'clock in the morning. According to the same friends, they left to catch a taxi home but never returned. If anyone has any information about their whereabouts, please contact detectives at Manton Police Station. Sophie feels a small chill of something ripple up and down her spine. She clicks through the rest of the links, looking for an update, but can't find anything. Just varying versions of the same report that the local paper carried. She then Googles Kim Knox, Upfield Common, and a few hits come up, including a couple of links to a village newsletter called the Upfield Gazetteer. One article in the newsletter is about a vigil held in June, marking the one-year anniversary of Tallulah and Zach's disappearance. There is a photograph attached to the article, an attractive woman with dark, mid-length hair, wearing a long floral dress with buttons down the front and a pair of black army boots, holding the hand of a very small boy, also dark-haired, clutching a single pink rose. A teenage boy in a dark shirt and combat trousers stands close to the woman. He bears a strong resemblance to her. Behind them is a sea of faces, a lot of young people. Kim Knox, 40, of Gable Close, Upfield Common, led a candlelit procession through the village on Saturday night to mark the first anniversary of the disappearance of her daughter, Tallulah Murray, who would have been 20 in March. Also commemorated during the ceremony was Zach Alistair, Tallulah's partner and father of her son, who would also have turned 20 in March. The procession began on the common and concluded at St. Bride's Chapel, where songs of hope and remembrance were sung by a choir from Tallulah's old school, Upfield High, where she was a student until 2016. Tallulah was studying social care at Manton College of Further Education when she disappeared in June of last year, after a night at a friend's house. The other link takes Sophie to an article from 3 months before that, a rose tree burial ceremony on the date of Tallulah's 20th birthday in March. The rose tree, an Australian shrub called Tallulah, has been planted behind the bus stop on the common, where Kim Knox used to watch her daughter as she waited for the bus to take her to college. Sophie turns away from the screen. She feels a chill of raw emotion pass through her at the thought of a woman holding back a curtain, peering across the street, looking for the shadow of her missing child, and seeing roses instead. Chapter 11, December 2016. Tallulah sits at her mother's dressing table.
Her mother has a magnifying mirror here, plus things like cotton wool balls and makeup brushes that Tallulah doesn't own, because Tallulah has never really enjoyed wearing makeup. She puts on mascara for special occasions and uses cover-up on her under-eye bags and any breakouts, but doesn't bother with the rest of it. The front sections of her dark hair are currently a kind of washed-out navy blue. She'd been hoping for the electric blue of the model on the packaging, but like everything in her life, it didn't turn out how she expected. She opens her mother's makeup bag and searches through it for liquid eyeliner, then sweeps the liner across her eyelids, trying to emulate the perfect wings the girls at college always seem to have. It's a disaster. She wipes them away and starts again. Eventually, she picks up her phone and texts her mum. Can you come upstairs and help me with my makeup? She feels a bit bad. Her mum does enough for her these days. Noah's napping and her mum is enjoying a rare moment of peace on her own. But a few seconds later, her mum replies with a thumbs-up emoji. And then she is there, her warmth filling the room immediately.
Right then, what do you need doing?
The wings? Tallulah replies, passing the liquid liner to her mother. I keep mucking them up. Her mother pulls a stool across the room and straddles it so that she is a few inches from Tallulah's face. Tallulah can smell the perfume on her neck. It's from the body shop and has a musk in it. Her mum says that musk makes men want to have sex with you, which strikes Tallulah as unlikely. Why would anyone bother doing all the other things you're supposed to do to make men want to have sex with you if you could just wear a particular perfume and be done with it? The outline of her mum's tattoo is just visible over the neckline of her top, the tip of a feather that further down forms part of a bird. Her mother has 6 tattoos. She had one done before Tallulah was born, and the rest after she was born. She has Tallulah's baby footprints tattooed in pale pink on the underside of her arm, 3 inches long, with her initials in a flourish underneath. On the underside of her other arm, she has Ryan's baby feet tattooed. On her back, she has a Japanese-style fish. On her ankle, she has a flock of swallows. And on her ring finger, she has a diamond. She says the diamond is to symbolise her marriage to herself. After she split up with Tallulah and Ryan's dad, she vowed never to marry again, and the tattooed engagement ring would mean she was already taken. Tallulah closes her eyes and angles her face towards her mother's outstretched hand. So? Says her mother, applying the brush to the rim of her left eye. What's with the makeup? It's the college Christmas party tonight. A disco in the canteen, famously awful, but she knows the cool kids will be there. Scarlett and her lot, because they're on the social planning committee. And she feels very keenly that if she doesn't go, she might miss out on something, but she's not entirely sure what. She shrugs.
Just felt like it, she says.
Her mother completes the second wing and she turns to see herself in the mirror. The wings are perfect.
Thanks, Mum, she says. You're the best.
What are you going to wear? Asks her mum.
That top, she says. You know, the one we got when we were at the Belfry last week, with the hearts on it, with my black jeans.
Oh, yes, her mum replies. That'll look lovely. Tallulah smiles. It's not the most amazing top in the world, but it'll hide her post-baby stomach, which just won't seem to snap back into shape no matter how hard she tries. That's the important thing. An hour later, she comes downstairs. Her mum has Noah on her lap, and they're watching CBeebies together. Ryan is at the dining table with headphones on, doing his homework.
You look gorgeous, says her mother. Just gorgeous.
Tallulah leans down to kiss Noah on both cheeks.
How are you getting there?
Chloe's giving me a lift.
Her mother nods.
Are you sure you'll be all right?
Tallulah asks, touching the crown of her baby's head.
I don't have to go if you'd rather I didn't.
Of course we'll be all right. It's bath time in a minute, isn't it, my angel?
Her mother's voice rises an octave or two as she turns to address Noah.
And after that, we'll have a lovely story and a lovely long sleep. Yes, yes, we will.
Noah turns and smiles at her, and Tallulah's mum kisses him hard on his cheek.
Off you go, she says.
Have fun. Let me know if you're going to be late.
I definitely won't be late, she says.
Chloe's mum wants her home by 11, so that's when I'll be back. Tallulah hears the sound of a car pulling up outside and dashes to the front door. Briefly, she appraises herself in the mirror there. She looks, she thinks, quite pretty. The first hour is every bit as crap as Tallulah had expected it to be. Shit sound system playing bad music. The hatch in the wall where the dinner ladies usually serve their lunch open and serving beer in plastic bottles and wine by the glass. She and Chloe sit on a bench with their backs to the wall, each holding a beer, watching the party unfold around them. Chloe went to school with Tallulah, primary and secondary. They were never particularly great friends, but have come together out of necessity during this first term at Manton. Then a buzz passes across the room, and inside the frame of the double doors appear Scarlett Jax and her gang. They're laughing between themselves, and none of them has made any effort to look nice. Scarlett's faded blue hair is tied back into two short pigtails. She's wearing baggy jeans and a leopard print vest top, and an oversized fake fur coat. The whole atmosphere of the room changes as they enter. Chloe tuts. What the fuck are they doing here? Tallulah turns. Why wouldn't they be here? They helped plan it. I would have thought they were way too edgy and cool for that sort of thing. Tallulah feels a strange wave of defensiveness pass through her. They're just people, she counters. But she knows it isn't true. They're more than just people. They're a mood, a feeling, a vibe, an aspiration. They're like a music video or a trailer for a really cool movie. They're a billboard poster for a hip clothing brand. Within the tiny fishbowl environs of Manton College, they're basically celebrities. Want another drink? She asks, getting to her feet. Chloe shakes her head. This is my limit, she says, miming driving a car.
Coke?
Sure, says Chloe. Diet, if they've got it. Tallulah tugs down her heart print shirt so that there's no gap between the waistband of her jeans and the hem of her shirt. No glimpse of the rice pudding mess left behind by her pregnancy. She heads to the hatch just as Scarlett and her crew arrive. They smell as though they've been drinking already, making a kind of mockery of Tallulah's sober hour in front of a mirror, her quiet farewell to her baby son on her mother's lap, her brother sitting at his laptop diligently doing his homework. How different their pre-party evenings have been. Scarlett stares at her phone while someone else queues to get her a drink. Her fur coat hangs off her shoulders, revealing a tattoo on her upper arm and a chiseled collarbone. She takes the beer from her friend's hand and as she does so, catches Tallulah's eye.
Oh, she says. Is Tallulah from the bus?
Tallulah nods.
Yep, she says. It's me from the bus.
They'd acknowledged each other a couple of times after their interaction at the bus stop that day a few weeks earlier. But that was as far as it had gone.
You look nice.
She tips her beer bottle towards Tallulah's face, a reference to her makeup, Tallulah assumes.
Thanks.
She almost says so do you, but then thinks better of it. The guy serving behind the bar looks at her inquisitively, and she orders her drinks. She expects, as she turns away from the bar, that Scarlett will have left to join her friends on the dance floor, but she's waiting for her. Tallulah tries to hide her surprise.
Cheers,
says Scarlett, knocking her plastic beer bottle against Tallulah's.
Cheers,
says Tallulah.
Who are you here with?
Scarlett glances around the room.
Chloe Minter.
She points at her friend, who is sitting scrolling through something on her phone.
She's in my year. She lives in the village near me, you know, and she was driving, so...
She shrugs, a suggestion that her reasons for being here with Chloe Minter are purely practical. Which in a way they are. The DJ puts on All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey, and there is a huge swell of excitement. Arms in the air, a dash to the dance floor.
Oh, oh, oh,
Scarlett says.
Come on, we've got to dance.
Tallulah blinks. She doesn't like dancing at the best of times,
but she doesn't want to sound miserable, so she laughs and says, I'm not drunk enough yet. Scarlett delves into one of the pockets on her huge fake fur coat and pulls out a copper hip flask.
Quick, she says. Nick it.
What is it?
Rum, she says. Really, really good rum. My dad bought it back from Barbados. It's like...
She makes a circle out of her thumb and index finger.
The best.
Tallulah sniffs the rim of the flask.
Can you smell the spice?
Says Scarlett. Tallulah nods, although really she can only smell the alcohol. She takes a sip and hands it back.
No, 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 says Scarlett.
That won't get you dancing.
More.
Tallulah tips the flask to her lips again and takes four huge slugs.
Drunk enough to dance now?
She nods and Scarlett pulls her onto the dance floor. They dance towards her friends and she twirls Tallulah in front of her, and Tallulah is conscious of her new top riding up as she lifts her arms and she tries to lower them, but Scarlett keeps pulling them up. Everyone is singing along and Tallulah can see some tutors joining in now, and people she wouldn't expect to be on a dance floor. And the alcohol pumps its way through her blood supply and into her brain, and suddenly she doesn't care about her porridge belly or Chloe sitting on the bench. She just wants to dance. Dance like she's 18 years old and doesn't have a care in the world, and there's no baby at home, no put-upon mother who should be out at a party herself tonight, no ex-boyfriend loitering in the wings trying to woo her back. Just her, 18 years old, in her first term at college, her whole life ahead of her, and the coolest girl in the world holding her hands above her head and grinning at her. Mariah, rum, glitter descending from the ceiling and landing at her feet and in her hair. The song comes to an end, and Scarlett finally lets her hands go.
Now, she says, Christmas has officially begun.
She makes a whooping noise and high-fives her friends, and then, just as Tallulah assumes she will fade away from her and back into the protective bubble of her little gang, Scarlett turns to her and says, Come outside with me. Tallulah looks over her shoulder anxiously at Chloe.
She'll be fine, says Scarlett.
Come on. She pulls her by the hand out of the double doors and into the entrance hall, then to the car park. The air is immediately icy cold, and while Scarlett is still wearing her huge fur coat, Tallulah is in only her short-sleeved cotton top.
Here,
says Scarlett, opening up her coat.
Room in here for two.
Tallulah looks at her uncertainly, before shrugging and smiling and nestling herself against Scarlett's bony frame and pulling the other side of her coat around her shoulders.
Where are we going? A little place I know.
Tallulah blinks at her, starting to feel strangely uneasy.
Don't look so scared.
I'm not scared.
Yeah, you are.
They move as one underneath the carapace of the huge fur coat and end up on a bench. Scarlett goes through the pockets of the big coat and pulls out a packet of cigarettes. She flips it open and offers it to Tallulah. Tallulah shakes her head. She's never smoked and never wants to.
Sorry to drag you out of there,
says Scarlett, plucking a cigarette from the packet.
Just realised I was too drunk. Way too drunk. Needed fresh air and fresh company.
She rolls her eyes. Tallulah throws her a look.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love them to death. I really, really do. But we've all been hanging out for so long. You know, we were all at Maypole House together and that place is really intense. I mean, really intense.
What were you doing there?
Oh, you know, just A-levels. I did the first term of sixth form at a boarding school, but then I got expelled. Nobody else would take me except the Maypole, so my dad bought a house close by so that I could be a day girl.
Scarlett shrugs and lights her cigarette.
What about you? Where did you go to school?
Oh, you know, Upfield High, just local.
Where do you live?
In a cul-de-sac, you know, on the other side of the common.
With your parents?
Yeah, well, with my mum and my brother. My dad lives in Glasgow. Her breath catches on the next thing she should say, the thing about her son, Noah. It's there, halfway up her throat, but she can't make it unstick. She doesn't know why. She's pretty sure that a girl like Scarlett would actually think it was quite cool that she had a baby and she was only 18. But for some reason, she doesn't want to be that girl tonight. The girl showing remarkable levels of maturity. The girl taking her responsibilities seriously. The girl who wakes with her baby every morning at 6 a.m, even at the weekends, who does her college work while her baby sleeps, who remembers to buy her own nappies and sterilise her own milk bottles bought with the allowance that her mother gives her, which other girls would spend on charcoal nose strips and false eyelashes from Superdrug. She's been that girl for 6 months, and she is good at being that girl. But right now, she is huddled under a fur coat in the cold with a skinny girl who probably wouldn't have a baby until she was at least 36, who gets expelled from boarding schools and smokes cigarettes and has tattoos and a stud pierced through her tongue. And for now, at least, Tallulah wants to be someone else.
Yeah, she finishes. Just us.
And have you always lived at Upfield?
Yes, born and bred.
So what's your dad doing in Glasgow?
He's Glaswegian. He moved back when he and my mum split up.
Scarlett inhales and nods.
What about you? Tallulah asks. Who do you live with?
She raises her brow. Well, ostensibly, I live with my mother and father, but my mother is kind of two-dimensional and my father is always away. But I have a brother. He's cool. I like him. And we have literally, like, the best dog in the world. He's a St. Bernard. Like, the size of a fucking pony, but thinks he's a regular dog. He's my best friend, literally. I'd be lost without him. I'd probably die.
I'd like a dog, Tallulah says. But my brother's got allergies.
Oh, God, you have to get a dog. Get a cockapoo or anything with poodle in it. They're hypoallergenic. Cavapoos are nice too. You just absolutely must get a dog.
For a moment, Tallulah finds herself idly fantasizing about a cavapoo, maybe one of those apricot-coloured ones with huge eyes and soft ears. She pictures herself walking it around the village and putting it in a shoulder bag to take it into shops. And then she stops and remembers that she cannot have a cavapoo because she has a baby.
Maybe, she says. Maybe.
Scarlett rubs out her cigarette on the ground beneath her heel and pulls the copper flask out of her pocket again. She takes a sip and passes it to Tallulah, who takes a sip and passes it back.
You're very cute, says Scarlett, eyeing her quite seriously. Do you know that?
No, not really.
You really are?
Something about your...
She tilts Tallulah's face upwards with her fingertip under her chin and studies her. I think it's your nose. The way it sort of tips up, just at the end there.
You look like Lana Del Rey.
Tallulah laughs hoarsely.
Don't be mad.
I think it's the eyeliner, plus the nose. She frames Tallulah's face with her hands.
You should always wear your eyeliner like that,
she says, slowly pulling away, but her eyes still taking in the detail of Tallulah's face. Tallulah feels something flash through her, the kind of adrenaline rush that you get when you nearly miss a step coming downstairs, a sort of thrilling sickness. And then a flashlight appears from the darkness and the sound of voices, and there is Scarlett's gang, incapable of surviving without the oxygen of their leader's presence for even 10 minutes before hunting her down.
Oh, there you are,
says one, almost cross with her for daring to be elsewhere.
Jaden said he thought you might have gone home.
Nope, just out here chatting with Tallulah from the bus.
The two girls look at Scarlett quizzically, and Tallulah sees them take in the shape of their bodies pressed together underneath Scarlett's coat and sees something like recognition pass across their faces. A small shock of understanding. And she wonders what it is that they've seen. They nod at her and she nods back, and Scarlett says,
This is Mimi and this is Rue. They're a pair of hoe bags I've known for about 100 years. This is Tallulah. Don't you think she's pretty? She says. Don't you think she looks a bit like Lana Del Rey? They look at her blankly, slightly awkwardly. Scarlett gets to her feet and her coat falls from Tallulah's shoulders and suddenly she is cold, very cold. She looks at the three girls, all of whom are lighting cigarettes and dancing together to the background thump of 8 Days of Christmas by Destiny's Child emanating from the dining hall. And she remembers Chloe sitting alone, waiting for her can of Diet Coke, and she says, I'd better get back in. My friend's waiting for me. Scarlett puts her hands on her hips and narrows her eyes at her in mock annoyance, and then smiles and says, See you around, Tallulah from the bus. Tallulah gives her an awkward thumbs up. She doesn't really know what else to say. And then she turns and heads back inside, where Chloe gives her a pained and questioning look. I'm really sorry, Tallulah says, sitting down next to her. I don't really understand what just happened. She just kind of hijacked me.
Weird,
says Chloe, wrinkling her nose slightly.
Yeah,
says Tallulah, caressing the curves of a rather warm plastic beer bottle and staring into the middle distance.
Yeah, it really was.
Chapter 12, June 2017. Kim leaves Carrie Anne's apartment and walks across the common with Ryan to Meg's house to collect Noah. He's asleep in his car seat when Meg brings him to the front door. Kim swallows a surge of annoyance. She specifically told Meg that Noah needed to stay awake because otherwise he wouldn't be tired at bedtime. And now she'll have to wake him up to get him out of his clothes and ready for bed, and he'll be grouchy and miserable and then won't want to sleep when she puts him down at bedtime. But Meg just smiles indulgently at him in his car seat, his dark hair damp with sweat, and says, Bless his little soul. He was exhausted. I couldn't bear to keep him awake. Kim smiles grimly and takes the handle of the car seat. Never mind, she says tightly. And I take it, Megs begins. Nothing about the kids. No, says Kim. Nothing about the kids. Although, did Zach happen to say anything to you about what he had planned for last night? No. I mean, I didn't even know they were going to the pub until you told me about it. Haven't really spoken to him the last few days. So you didn't know anything about... Kim pauses, wondering whether to spoil the surprise or not, then decides that, no, getting to the bottom of the whereabouts of Zach and Tallulah is more important than surprises right now. A ring? She finishes. A ring? Yes, an engagement ring. Did Zach say anything to you about proposing to Tallulah? Megs laughs.
God,
she says.
No!
Kim narrows her eyes at her. She has no idea why Meg should find this concept funny. Is there anyone else that Zach might have talked it through with? A friend? His dad?
His friends, I suppose, but I've already spoken to all of them and none of them knows anything about what happened last night. And no, he wouldn't talk to his dad about it. His dad's not that sort of man. Not much emotional intelligence, you know.
Kim stifles a wry smile. She's rarely met anyone with less emotional intelligence than Meg's. She sighs. Fine, she says. Okay, well, I'd better get this little man home and try and persuade him to wake up, and then try and persuade him to go back to sleep again. Meg smiles at her blankly. She has no clue. Please let me know if you hear anything, won't you? Kim asks. I'm going to call the police about Tallulah if she's not back by the time Noah's asleep. You might want to do the same. Megs shrugs. Still reckon the two of them have run away somewhere for a break from it all. But yes, maybe I should be worried. You might be right. Kim turns then and heads to her car, shaking her head almost imperceptibly as she walks, her eyes closing against the impossibility of understanding how a mother and a grandmother could have so little engagement with their roles.
The first half of the evening passes quickly as she goes through the process of readying a year-old child for bed. Noah, as she predicted, won't settle, and it's almost 9 p.m. by the time he finally drops off. Kim craves wine, but she needs to remain clear-headed and sober because her evening is far from over. She sits in the living room. There's something on the TV. She doesn't really know what. Some loud Saturday night fare. Ryan sits in his armchair, scrolling through his phone, his foot bouncing up and down, the only thing betraying his anxiety. She calls Tallulah's number yet again. It goes through to voicemail, yet again. She looks at Ryan.
"Did Zach say anything to you?"
she says.
"About proposing to Tallulah?"
She immediately knows that he has by the slight jerk of Ryan's head, the immediate cessation of the foot bouncing.
"Why?"
he says.
"I just wondered. I found a ring in his coat pocket yesterday. I thought maybe he'd been planning to propose last night. It made sense, you know, given he was taking her out for the night."
"Well, yeah, he did kind of say he was thinking about it. But he didn't say when he was planning on doing it."
"What did he say exactly?"
"Just asked me what I thought. Said, did I think she'd say yes if he asked her?"
"And what did you say?"
"I said I didn't have a clue, because I didn't." She nods. Then she looks at the time. It's 9 o'clock. It's enough, she thinks. Enough. It's time.
With a racing heart and a sickening swirl in the pit of her stomach, she calls the police, and she files a missing persons case. A very attractive man is at her door the following morning. He wears a grey suit and a cream open-necked shirt, ID on a lanyard. He pulls a badge from his jacket pocket and flashes it at her.
"Detective Inspector Dominic McCoy," he says. "You called about some missing persons last night?"
Kim nods, hard.
"Yes, yes, good, yes. Please, come in."
She has barely slept. She brought Noah into her bed eventually because he wouldn't settle in his cot after his nighttime wake-up, and the two of them had lain there in the dark, blinking up at the ceiling. At one point he turned to her, grabbed her cheek with one hot hand, and said, "Amma." He'd said it 3 more times before she realised that he was trying to say "Mama." That he was trying to speak his first full word.
"Come through," Kim says now, leading Dominic McCoy into her living room. "Can I get you anything?"
"No, I've just had a coffee, so I'm good, thank you."
They sit facing each other across the coffee table and Kim passes Noah a packet of rice cakes to keep him quiet for a while.
"So my colleague tells me that your daughter failed to come home on Friday night. Is that correct?"
Kim nods.
"My daughter and her boyfriend, he lives with us. They both failed to come home."
"And they're how old?"
"They're both 19. They turned 19 in March.
D.I. McCoy looks at her strangely, as if she shouldn't be worried about a couple of 19-year-olds.
"But they're parents," she continues. "Noah is their son, so it's not as if they're likely to just take off on a whim. They're good parents, responsible."
He nods thoughtfully.
"I see."
She wonders what it is that he thinks he sees. But then she answers his questions about the events of Friday and Saturday. She gives him Scarlett's address, Lexi's address, Meg's address. She almost mentions the engagement ring, but then decides against it at the last minute. She's not sure why. Half an hour later, he stands to leave.
"So, what do you think then?" Kim asks. "What do you think might have happened to them?"
"Well, there's no real reason to believe that anything has happened to them. 2 youngsters, a lot of responsibility. Their first night out in a long time. Maybe they just made a break for freedom."
"No,"
she replies immediately. "Absolutely not. They're devoted to their son, both of them. Particularly my daughter. Absolutely devoted to him." He nods thoughtfully.
"And the boyfriend? Zach? Was he in any way controlling, would you say? Were there any signs of abuse going on?"
"No," she replies again, almost too fast.
as she tries to override the uncomfortable little doubts she's starting to have. He adores Tallulah, dotes on her, almost too much.
Too much?
She realizes what she said and retreats.
No, not too much, but, you know, it gets on her nerves sometimes, I guess.
I wouldn't mind being doted on like that, he says with a smile.